So we'll start with experts. And the first case we're going to discuss is coastal transport, which is kind of old at this point. But it set off this dichotomy between when you can raise complaints about expert testimony that's conclusory or speculative, and the fact that you can do that after trial, even if you didn't object to the testimony in real time, versus problems with an expert's methodology or reliability challenges, which require a contemporaneous objection. And so I'm sure many of you are familiar with this case. There was a negligence and gross negligence theories. The opinion from the expert on gross negligence, and specifically the conscious indifference part, so the subjective element of gross negligence, the plaintiff's expert answered these two questions with just a yes. And there was no objection to the testimony, but you'll see that the lawyer's question is really just reciting the conscious indifference standard, and then the expert says, yes, that's what happened. So you do have something that looks more like what I think most people on first blush would say, that looks like conclusory testimony. The trial court directed a verdict on gross negligence. The Court of Appeals actually reversed because of this testimony from this expert. And then the Supreme Court takes the case and reverses the Court of Appeals, putting the trial court's judgment back in place, saying that this testimony is conclusory. And so it didn't matter that the party had not objected during trial, because having an expert just say yes to the legal standard is non-probative on its face. And the court contrasted that situation, which didn't require an objection and could be raised after trial, with when a court is looking at an expert's methodology and has to look beyond what the expert is saying into what the expert did, and an objection is necessary to that. And so as Daryl and I were working on this paper, I read this case and I'm like, okay, well, that makes great sense to me. And we'll kind of get through how this evolves. But before we get there, Daryl's going to talk through sort of why maybe this didn't make as much sense if you saw the law evolve.
So when we talked about this, I thought the thing that was refreshing is that Kelsey's been out for 6 or 7 years and I've been out for 30-something years, right? So coastal makes sense. When you look at it, it does seem conclusory. You have somebody testifying about somebody's subjective knowledge. And so what did they know? Facially conclusory. It all makes sense to us now. But the reason I think it didn't trigger Kelsey is because she didn't have 30 years of when it was so different. And to appreciate coastal, we should go back and look at Maritime Overseas versus Ellis, because I think that's where it started and then it sort of evolves. Very briefly, Maritime was an exposure to diazinon, an industrial roach killer case. And the plaintiff had 5 medical doctors testify that diazinon exposure caused the plaintiff's delayed neurotoxicity neuropathy. There were no objections to the reliability of scientific evidence until after the jury verdict. The plaintiff obtained a verdict. The Court of Appeals affirmed in part, including on the sufficiency of the evidence to support the causation finding. And the Supreme Court affirmed, and then they had this language, which I think seems so interesting now, 24 years later. Permitting a party to challenge on appeal the reliability of an opposing party's scientific evidence under Daubert, under the guise of an insufficiency of the evidence argument, would give a party an unfair advantage. Thus, to prevent trial by ambush, we hold that the complaining party must object to the reliability of scientific evidence before trial or when the evidence is offered. And they reject the defendant's request in 1998 to apply the Daubert-Robinson-Havner analysis to methodology, saying you have to have a timely objection. Well, I think when we were all folks who were practicing back then, it made sense from a preservation perspective, right? The other party is going to have an opportunity to cure it, and if the trial court is going to have an opportunity to cure it in real time, since they're the gatekeeper, then it requires an objection. So we go then from Maritime, and now I'm going to fast forward you 21 years later, or I'm sorry, 11 years later, in the city of San Antonio versus Pollock. And it was a public nuisance case on benzene exposure. And the issue was whether the exposure to benzene caused leukemia in utero. There was no objection to the reliability or admission of expert testimony. There was an objection on legal insufficiency at trial in a motion for directed verdict, a motion for judgment NOV, and a motion for new trial. Again, the plaintiff obtained a favorable verdict, the Court of Appeals affirmed, and in this case, the Supreme Court reversed and rendered and went a little bit different direction. And if you look at, we have these figures sort of scratching their head because this is, I think, City of San Antonio versus Pollock. The first time, it's hard to sort of tease out whether it's a reliability challenge and we're talking about methodology and analytical gaps, or we're talking about conclusory evidence. Coastal, I think, didn't offend anybody because it was so facially conclusory. And we're used to that in affidavits and other error preservation. But Pollock was different, and it seemed like a very savvy person who gets it on appeal and says, you know what, we didn't have any objections, so we're going to sort of fashion this a little bit differently. And I think it was Sharon Calloway and Pam Barron who had the Pollock case. Unsurprising, they're both so bright that they would come up with this theory. And the dissent had sort of an interesting observation. The opinions and testimony here are far more removed from the bare conclusions we rejected as conclusory in Coastal. And they noticed the difference. The city's complaints about analytical gaps are nothing more than an unpreserved reliability challenge.